To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa.
Thank you to the billionaires who did that particular song for my movie In Debt We Trust back in 2006 forecasting the financial collapse. And I tried to play it at least once a week on this program because, of course, it remains extremely timely and topical. In fact, just yesterday or the other day, the federal government sued the Bank of America for $1 billion, claiming that it engaged, oh, horrors, in predatory practices, vicious practices against people who are taking out mortgages. In fact, there's a lot more to this because the administration has been, people have been begging it, pleading with it, please do something about 14 million families in foreclosure. Stop these foreclosures. Stop the banks. Prosecute the CEOs. That has not happened yet. And an announcement of a lawsuit just a few days before the election is no substitute for policy and practice of actually going after these institutions. That hasn't happened and is unlikely to happen. In fact, if you look carefully at this lawsuit on Bank of America, it's really about them ripping off Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, not ordinary people. It's not clear if the money, if they do get $1 billion from the Bank of America, which says, of course, they're not guilty of any of these practices, if any of that will go to the people who have been really hurt and have lost their homes and have lost their hope as a result of these foreclosure practices and financial crimes. But this is a theme, an issue that I've been focusing on, and I'm happy to focus on it again this week. Here in the studio with me is Kat Waters. Hi, Kat.
Bad Bank of America, bad for America.
Okay, that's a slogan we can live with.
That's our chant.
Also joining us, Julie Teresas, who is an activist who's just come back from Pakistan and is going to give us a discussion of what the drone situation there is and how people in Pakistan feel about it. She's part of, you know, the valiant peace warriors of Code Pink, who we've featured on our program many times. Julie, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to have this conversation in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to add a little historical perspective to what we're talking about and what we talk about on this program. And I was pleased to find out about a new book about Mark Twain's Tale of Today. Donald Tiffany Bliss, a U.S. government official for many years, serving also in an international law firm, former U.S. ambassador to the International Civil Aviation Organization, appointed the first executive secretary to the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare by Elliot Richardson, who's work I knew well in Massachusetts, and he also served in the Environmental Protection Agency. Don has been a Washington lawyer for many years. He's also connected to the family that published Mark Twain's work. He's a great-grandson of Alicia Bliss, who is the president, as everyone out there will remember, of the American Publishing Company in Hartford, Connecticut, which published six of Mark Twain's early books. Are you with me, Don?
Yes, I am. It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us on the program. We're jumbling, but our first guest is now our second guest, but you're now our first guest. But, you know, that's the radio and that's the way things work. I want to tell us about your love of Mark Twain. Why should we really discover Mark Twain for those of us who haven't? Tell us a little bit about him, because I feel like he was not only one of the greatest American writers of all time, but he was also a very principled person who critiqued American politics, who critiqued imperialism and was part of the anti-imperialist league, who was satirical of both parties. He wasn't, you know, working for one and engaging in what we have in our elections, which is selective, talking points. He was an original with original observations that combined music, poetry, humor. He was a major figure in our lives and at one point in our country, and he deserves to be so again. So when I saw this book, Donald, Tiffany Bliss, Mark Twain's Tale of Today, I leapt at it because I think this is the Lord's work in telling us about Mark Twain. Tell me about Mark Twain and your life and why you wrote this and what you hope people can get from what Mark Twain had to say so many years ago.
Well, right. I mean, Mark Twain, there were so many dimensions to Mark Twain, and most people think of him as the first authentic American author. I think Ernest Hemingway said all American literature comes from one source, Huckleberry Finn. But there was another aspect to Mark Twain that really has intrigued me because I've lived and worked in the Washington area now for 40 years. And that was...
Sorry for you? No. Okay, go ahead.
He was America's first global celebrity. He was a much sought-after commentator on politics and policy, public policy, dressed in an all-white suit and his white hair, ever-present cigar. He always thought that the truth went down a little better with a dose of humor, so he was a pretty sharp and acerbic wit. But underneath the pithy aphorisms, I think, is an underlying truth. And you're right. He was a man of principle, a moralist in disguise. He said, I'm a moralist in disguise, and it gets me in a heap of trouble when I go thrashing around in political questions. But most people don't know it, but actually, as a young man, he actually worked for a senator from Nevada, William Stewart. And he was a senator's clerk for about a month or so till he was fired. He had a tendency to tell the truth, and that didn't serve him well during the Gilded Age. And my interest in Mark Twain, this book sort of combines two interests. My one, having observed American politics over a period of time, I think it kind of goes in cycles, and we're down in a down cycle. Are we ever?
Yeah, go ahead.
And secondly, it's the family connection. We've always had a real interest in Mark Twain because of my great-grandfather and grandfather worked in the publishing business. And although Mark Twain had his falling out with my great-grandfather, he said Elijah Bliss told the truth once in his life, and it was such a strain he died on the spot. So,
speaking of death, I mean, this is the week that we're remembering George McGovern. Kat has been thinking about George McGovern, who, of course, ran for president opposing the Vietnam War in 1972, lost soundly to Richard Nixon, who then, came to power and fell because of the Watergate scandal. But George McGovern, with his appeal, Come Home, America, folksy man from the South Dakota, was somebody who really touched a nerve with a lot of people of conscience, and we miss him. Russell Means, the Native American activist, also died this week. But this is leading me to something, Donald, which is this quote from Mark Twain that's in your book, where Mark Twain writes, he says, I came in with Halley's Comet in 1835. It is coming again next year, and I expect to go out with it. It will be the greatest disappointment of my life if I don't go out with Halley's Comet. The Almighty has said no doubt. Now here go these two unaccountable freaks. They came in together. They must go out together. And guess what? In 1909, when he made this statement, he was predicting his own death when Halley's Comet returned. On its 75th year cycle, Mark Twain died April 21st, 1910. So that's the way you start your book, and it grabbed me, I must say. And this, his writing has grabbed me. I mean, he really took a lot of risks, didn't he, to stand up for what he believed in?
He certainly did. And, I picked the Halley's Comet as a metaphor because Mark Twain did believe in the historical repetition, periodic repetition of history. Like the Halley's Comet, it comes back every 75 years on schedule. And when he wrote his first novel, which my great-grandfather published with Charles Dudley Warner, who was the editor of the Hartford Courant, it was called The Gilded Age, A Tale of Today. And it was really about the scandals of the Grant administration and the corruption in Congress, the money, the power of money and lobby in the Congress of the United States. That was part of it. The other was speculation in the financial markets. And in a sense, when he said A Gilded Age, A Tale of Today, my book is a takeoff on that, because in some ways we're seeing a return of the Gilded Age. As Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. and we're seeing, you know, the same sort of thing, the boom and bust economies, the increasing disparity between the very wealthy and the middle class and poor, you know, the cultural changes that come from abrupt changes in technology. And in the Gilded Age, it was the railroads and communications, the telephone, telegraph, and today it's the internet.
We have some occupiers of Wall Street in the studio with us right now, and they I think are resonating.
We're with twinkling.
I think they're resonating with what you're saying, because, you know, this has happened before. You know, that there's a lot of talk, of course, of business cycles that, you know, in a sense, you know, crisis is built into our system and it periodically surfaces. There have been many economists who have pointed this out, that this is not new, but it does seem to be extremely severe, and that's what's sort of troubling about it. What was Mark Twain's assessment of this Gilded Age? How did he see it?
Well, I think Mark Twain, first of all, he did believe in the free enterprise system, and he thought that invention and innovation that adds value to the economy should be rewarded. He was a great believer in patents, and he was a friend of Thomas Edison and Westinghouse, and he thought that people that contributed to the economy through invention and innovation should be rewarded. But he went after the robber barons like Commodore Vanderbilt and Jay Gould. He thought Jay Gould said money is God and made, you know, the nation will take 100 years to recover from the damage done by Jay Gould, the corruption and the conspiracy and the monopolization. And so his view of free enterprise was it should reward innovation and invention, but it had to come down hard on the robber barons who were abusing the private enterprise system.
That hasn't happened today, has it? I mean, we haven't seen them coming down hard. This Mr. Gupta was sentenced for insider trading, but you notice the emphasis is on people who rip off other investors, not necessarily the people who rip off the American people, who are responsible for the way in which people in other parts of the world who are living on $2 a day are now living on $1 a day, in large part because of this global financial crisis and the lack of caring that we've seen right here on Wall Street about how their policies and practices impact on the rest of our culture and society.
Yes, and when he worked for Congress, he was an eyewitness, and then in the novel The Gilded Age, it makes clear that we have this fantasy in America that somehow back in the 19th century, when the government didn't interfere with private enterprise, people were successful and the economy was doing well, and now we have all this government regulation. But in fact, what was happening during the Gilded Age is that the railroads were all in Congress with hundreds of lobbyists lobbying for special legislation that would give them land grants and bond guarantees. And Congress picked winners and losers, and the winners were the ones who had the lobbyists who, you know, essentially in those days paid the bribes. And today, with all the statutes and all the regulations that we've passed, the one thing that Leon Panetta, a former member of Congress, now Secretary of Defense, and Jack Abramoff, a convicted lobbyist, have in common is they both have been quoted as saying, we today have a system of legalized bribery. We have a system that allows so much money to go into the political process, to the legislative process, and it's all legal. But the money buys access, and access buys legislation and benefits for those who can afford to pay for it. That's unfortunately the way the system works these days.
If I could share just really quickly, the other day at Foley Square, they had a pretty cool event. It was called the Caravan of Corruption. Mm-hmm. And they present, you know, it was like 15 senators of New York State that were found, you know, like corruption and just, you know, using money for personal things. It was about 15 of them. They had like 3-foot-high caricatures of each of them and a small little placard kind of saying, you know, like what they did. You know, they were incarcerated. So, like the one guy even died.
See,
and it was really interesting. And they were up in Kingston, too. And
yeah, but these are like individuals who are, you know, in a sense, beneficiaries and practitioners of this corruption. But there was an article in the New York Times, I don't know if you saw this, Don, on Wednesday. It was the lead article, suddenly out of nowhere. The New York Times economic correspondent gets to write the lead story for the New York Times. And the headline is, Living Standards in the Shadows as Election Issues. Family Incomes Slump. A divide between talk from the candidates and economic reality. And the article goes to kind of pretty clearly state that taxes and government spending, health care, immigration, financial regulation, all of the so-called issues of the debates are totally irrelevant to what's happening to millions of people whose lives are falling apart, who can't pay their bills, who are losing their homes, who are losing their jobs and not finding new ones. And it says here, many of the bedrock assumptions of American culture about work, progress, fairness, and optimism are being shaken as successive generations worry about the prospects of declining living standards. No question, perhaps, is more central to the country's global standing than whether the economy will perform better on that score in the future than it has in the past. Now, these are issues that Mark Twain considered and thought about and wrote about. And Mark Twain was a very popular writer. I mean, he was not writing, just for a handful of people. He was really celebrated in the culture of his times.
That's absolutely true. You know, in a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, he talks about a Connecticut Yankee trying to bring democracy to the Camelot, to King Arthur's Court, and the oppression of the established church, the nobility who were given all kinds of special privileges, and the common people who were oppressed. And unfortunately, the book doesn't turn out very well. The people of King Arthur's Court really aren't ready for democracy. Maybe there's a lesson in there for the Spring Awakening in the Middle East. But Richard B. Hayes, who ran for president, Mark Twain supported him and insisted on serving only one term because he said, I couldn't really run for re-election because people wouldn't know whether my policies were designed to get me re-elected or for the best interest of the people. So he insisted that he could only serve one term, and he advocated a 6-year term for the presidency for that purpose. But he wrote in his diary, he read King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain. He thought Mark Twain was a wonderful author, and he said, you know, the real lesson of this book is that unfortunately, Abraham Lincoln said we were a nation of the people, by the people, for the people, but we're now becoming a nation of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich. And this was in Rutherford B. Hayes' diary, and that was the message he took from Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee at King Arthur's Court.
What's interesting is, you know, Mark Twain advocated pervasive education and informed and engaged electorate and the election of representatives who think and act independently, regardless of political affiliation. He claimed that if we would learn what the human race really is at bottom, we need only observe it in election times. He was a fierce critic of the betrayal of democracy and the need for education. And today, as you can see, increasingly in our media, there's less and less education or context or background. That's why, you know, I've been involved with a website that's coming back strong, mediachannel.org, that you want to be part of if you can, because what we're doing is analyzing what's happening to our politics through our media. Right now, you could check it out at mediachannel1.org, but it will be back as mediachannel.org very soon. And I also blog every day at newsdissector.net to critique media coverage, to analyze it. And I think Mark Twain would have approved of that. He once said that, you know, there are only two powers in the world. I don't know if you remember this one. If you remember this one, Donald, there were two powers in the world, the God in the heavens And the Associated Press on Earth. That's what he was saying, you know, about the power of American media. And the Associated Press, for many years, was a not-for-profit cooperative of newspapers. Increasingly, though, it has really been dominated by major establishment figures, and it's not known for the kind of investigative muckraking and you know, kind of articles that Mark Twain wrote repeatedly, unfortunately.
You're right. You know, you referenced the fact Mark Twain never joined a political party, and he thought that the problem with political parties is that they created a herd-like mentality from people. They just only listen to one point of view, and they wanted reinforcement of their biases rather than thinking things through for themselves. So he said that the problem with the American political system is that politicians and voters put loyalty to party ahead of loyalty to country. And I think here in Washington we have this gridlock today because the parties seem to go into caucuses like they're playing professional football games or something. They huddle together and think, how are they going to outmaneuver the other party, and lose sight of the fact that they've got their obligation, that they've been sent here to promote the public interest, to look after the interest of the American people. And, I've never seen the gridlock worse than it's been in recent years in Washington.
Stalemate.
Yeah, Mark Twain warned us about that. I mean, he, like George Washington, he really didn't think political parties were compatible with the type of government that we have created. And he became what is called a mugwump. And the mugwumps basically said, we will vote for the best man. In those days, it was the best man. And fortunately, and the president's always been a man. I hope the day will come soon, I would hope. And Mark Twain became a strong advocate of women's suffrage and women's rights. So I think he definitely, and particularly in his later years, would have welcomed a woman president. But
who did Mark Twain vote for?
Well, that's an interesting question.
I'm curious to know what he would think of the choices that we have to vote for. Coming up?
I'm not going to go there. I'll tell you, he wanted three things. He would vote for Governor Romney, he would vote for President Obama, or he would not vote at all. He would keep his ballot clean. You know, when McKinley was running against William Jennings Bryan, he didn't vote. And he said, I couldn't fathom the wildcat financial theories of Bryan, and I couldn't believe in a president who would send our boys over to occupy the Philippines and soil the flag through American imperialism. So I kept my ballot clean and would keep it until we had a decent candidate.
Yeah.
And when Roosevelt was running against Parker, he did the same thing. He was in Europe at the time. He said, if I were in the United States, I'd come back and lobby against both these scoundrels, because he thought the occupation of the Philippines was an unjust extension of American power. And he thought the Democrats were too tied to corruption, Tammany Hall, and he didn't like their economic theories. So he basically kept his ballot clean. But he did vote. He's campaigned for Rutherford B. Hayes. He worked for Grover Cleveland because he thought Grover Cleveland in New York had defeated Tammany Hall. And, Grover Cleveland vetoed 414 bills in one term. The only president that's vetoed more bills was Franklin Roosevelt. He had more time to do it. Cleveland would not sign any special interest legislation. He was a real straight arrow when it came to the presidency, and he didn't care what he would appoint people from either party, whoever he thought was most qualified for the job. And Mark Twain respected that. Now, Grover Cleveland hasn't gone down as one of our great presidents, but I think that Mark Twain would say that's a mistake.
Well, only on this show would we be discussing, the election of 1900 as opposed to the election of 2012.
Right, right.
But, in discussing the election of 1900, we are discussing the election of 2012. And I think, the war in the Philippines is something that most Americans really don't know much about. And it was the Vietnam before Vietnam in Asia. 6 million died there. It was a savage charnel house of all kinds of murder and corruption in the name of I don't know what. I remember a famous saying when McKinley was told, he said, look, we're fighting to Christianize the Philippines. And so he said, excuse me, Mr. President, I think that they've been Catholics for 300 years.
The Dominican friars, I guess, didn't do a good enough job.
You know what I'm saying? So the distortion of all of this is rather important. I just wanted to mention, you know, Mark Twain's commitment to pervasive education is something that I resonate with as well. Just today, a newspaper in Riverdale in the Bronx, New York, has an article for anybody who's in Riverdale or reads the Riverdale Press about a film that I'm making about the high school I went to there, DeWitt Clinton High School, and a high school that educated probably 250,000 kids over the course of a century in New York City. And the whole future of public education is at risk right now from charter schools and people who that, you know, teach to the test and all this. So if you're interested in the DeWitt Clinton High School film project, the Riverdale Press, or you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Just one last question, your reaction, to this recent debate, and we're going to ask our guest here, who's in the studio with us, who's going to be telling us about drones, to comment on the debate on foreign policy, where it seemed as if Mr. Romney and Mr. Obama couldn't agree with each other more.
Yeah, I thought if we had one more debate, Romney might endorse Obama. You know, he keeps moving more and more toward Obama's position, and over the three debates, it's really quite interesting to watch. But my most amusing part of the debates was the Romney plan of 20% tax cuts for Americans, $2 trillion more for defense, and he's going to reduce the deficit. And the president keeps saying it doesn't make – there's no mathematics to support your position. You're not going to tell us how you're going to pay for all the $7 trillion of extra expenditures in your economic plan. This is a secret that you're not revealing to the
American
people.
You've lived in Washington
people.
For 40 years.
Yeah.
Do you really want the facts to get in the way of an
exactly.
argument? I mean,
I think Mark Twain explained the answer, you know, over 100 years ago, and he said that if the Democrats put the multiplication table into their platform, the Republicans would vote it down at election time.
Right.
And the fact is you don't have to have math. It doesn't have to add up. And people can make all kinds of promises in an election. And Mark Twain certainly felt that elections were almost a waste of time because the platforms and the promises and the pledges were all beside the point when people – and that's why he wanted a person of character with a record – that was what guided him when he decided who to vote for, not what they said during election time, because he had a wonderful essay in 1863 of the Great Prize Fight, which was a gubernatorial election between Leland Stanford and Fernando Lowe, and they basically beat each other to a pulp in the boxing ring. And the metaphor is that that's what happens in elections. The candidates beat each other up with negative advertising. Twain had a lot to say about negative advertising, demonizing the opposition, mischaracterizing the position of the opposition, and so forth.
What we're saying, if you want to understand what's happening in America today, read Mark Twain, even though he wrote about it years ago, and read Donald Tiffany Bliss's book, Mark Twain's Tale of Today.
Yeah, worth, you can find it on Amazon.com.
Worth reading and worth pondering. Julie, just one reaction from you, and we're going to get into this in more detail in the next segment. This reference to drones with Mr. Romney and Mr. Obama basically saying amen to each other in support of drones.
Well, given that facts don't have the place that they should in our discourse and there aren't enough media entities like Media Channel or Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, it's makes it difficult to do my job of trying to raise awareness of what's really going on with the drone policy. But what they're saying, amen, and I agree with you on, is the killing of innocent civilians, and estimates are that the drones kill anywhere between 60 to 80% of the people that are killed are innocent civilians, including women and children.
Jolie, let's hold that for the next segment because we want to give you time to really tell us about your trip to Pakistan and your reflections on drones. That's coming up here on News Dissector Radio. Stay with us, if you will, here on PRN FM. The number to call if you want to join us, 888-874-4888. Stay with us.
That are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
This is corrupt!
Something's wrong in America!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game.
This is corrupt!
Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
Version of Home Sweet Home by Polarity One, Paul Levine. Home Sweet Home is one of the first recorded songs in America about the importance of homes, and it's really an anthem of what's happened to people's homes in this foreclosure crisis and financial crisis. And I'm playing it this week, particularly because of the lawsuit against the Bank of America, which earlier settled all these other suits for discrimination. For, you know, buying a Merrill, all kinds of cases, millions and millions of dollars in litigation and all the rest of it. And none of their major executives have gone to jail, have been prosecuted in any way whatsoever. So, you know, we're talking about an era not just of war crimes overseas, but financial crimes here in America that go unpunished. And joining us now is... And we have an interesting report for you from Jolie Tarasis, who was part of a delegation that went to Pakistan as part of Code Pink to try to investigate on the ground the impact of drone warfare. And I really thank you for coming on the program today to tell us about your experiences. How did you get into this trip, and what did you experience there?
Well, thanks so much for having me and giving me this opportunity to speak about my amazing experience that I had there. I'll start off by talking about how I learned about the trip a little bit. I was at the Occupy National Gathering in Philadelphia, and Medea Benjamin was there with Code Pink, and they gave a talk on drones and asked if anyone would like to put their name down on this list if they were interested in traveling to Pakistan to protest the U.S. policy on the use of drones and to be peace delegates and try to raise awareness among Pakistani people that there are people in the U.S. who are against their government and against the slaughter of innocents in their country. And so I was interested immediately, and I don't have a spouse or dependents. It was seemed like a good time to risk my life for something I believe in. And I also have an inherent mistrust, like a lot of us do, about our media and when they describe a place as being very dangerous. I wonder who has what sort of agenda to paint it as such. And I do think that's part of what's coming into play in keeping people from traveling to places where there are a lot of victims from drone strikes, such as the north and south Waziristan areas in the Fatah regions of Pakistan.
So you were interested, and you signed a piece of paper, and then what happened?
And then I had to do a bunch of fundraising, and from about 30 people or so, to whom I'm very grateful, I had donations ranging from $3 to $200. The total trip was about $2,500. The plane ticket alone was close to $1,500, and that was more expensive than it should have been, because we had to wait to the last minute to get our visas approved. And there were two prominent journalists whose visas were rejected on the grounds that the Pakistani government would not be able to guarantee our safety. But our visas were approved last minute. And I also, as a lot of other delegates did on the trip, had to deal with a lot of intense concern from family members who wanted very much to dissuade us from attending. My own mother offered to pay back all of my donors and have my aunt donate $1,000 on top of that to Code Pink if I would only not go.
It sounds a little bit like my parents when when I went to Vietnam in 1974 during the war. And, you know, I still remember my father, "You're going where? Why?" And, so of course they were worried and concerned about you. I understand that. But you persisted and you went. So tell me about the trip.
So basically it was...
And by the way, just one last point. If you are going to India or Pakistan, talk to me. I have a friend in the air travel business who might be able to find a good deal for you.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Go ahead. For future trips. Okay.
So it was overwhelmingly a very positive and amazing experience. For the most part, all the Pakistani people that we met were so appreciative that we were there, and also really seemed to relish the opportunity to speak to an American and ask us about why are things the way they are and why do we elect the leaders that we do. And I try to explain that a lot of us feel like we don't have much of a choice, and that because they were asking, well, a lot of you Americans that we meet say that you're against your governmental policies, but yet there's almost 50% of the people over there that are going to support Romney or Obama, who are both come across as very pro-drone. And so they're asking, why is that? So from there, I tried to explain that people may vote for Obama or Romney and also simultaneously be very much against the drone policy because they feel like they don't have a choice. And it's sort of not a true democracy that we have over here, in the opinion of many.
I just wanted to ask you about the visa that you spoke about. I mean, like, just having a passport is not good enough?
No, you have to get a visa also. And then there was some talk of how we were supposed to get additional documentation to enter Waziristan. But some people were saying that we did, and some people were saying that we didn't. And then ultimately, Code Pink wasn't allowed to enter Waziristan because they were blocked by the Pakistani government.
What did you guys do over there? Like, how did you spoke to the people?
We had our schedule was pretty much jam packed with all types of events. We spoke with human rights activists and feminists, and also we went to a press conference with Imran Khan, who is the chairperson and the political leader of the PTI party. Which we joined up. We were going to do the march to Waziristan anyway, but we joined up with Imran Khan and his party to do the march to Waziristan on October 7th, which was the anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan, which is also another reason why that date was chosen. The purpose of that march was to talk to drone victims in Waziristan and see for ourselves what is going on in this quote-unquote dangerous area where there's so many quote-unquote militants that supposedly merits these attacks on and is supposedly making us safer.
How many Code Pink? How many?
There were 31 delegates.
31 people went?
Yes.
Wow, that's a big group. And in going there, what I'm sure you guys discussed everything that you were experiencing and what you were seeing. What was the feeling there? I mean, were you surprised? Did you learn things there that you didn't know before by relying on our press accounts?
One of the most interesting things that I learned is has to do with the complex political arena and how if someone is anti-drone, it often gets lumped together with being pro-Taliban. And a lot of people, we met some activists on the left who were very much afraid of the Taliban and almost came across as pro-drone in that they were asking, okay, if you're not going to use drones, how are you going to deal with that militancy up in that area? And so we were careful to and tried to explain that we can be anti-drone and also be anti-militancy and anti-Taliban and very much against and horrified by actions of the Taliban, such as the attack on Malala Yousafzai, the 14-year-old girl who was shot and is thankfully recovering and hopefully will be fully recovered soon.
How long did you stay there for?
I left on October 1st. I got there on October 3rd and then came back on October 11th.
So this is fairly recent. I mean, this is this month.
Yes.
You were in Pakistan. And, you know, I don't know there was another delegation like this. That during the Vietnam War, there were delegations of American anti-war activists who went to Hanoi, went to then Saigon, went to Cambodia to do, you know, fact-finding on the ground to try to find out what was happening. But because of the terror war and because of 9/11, there are many people who are very reluctant to express any criticisms whatsoever, lest they be labeled a terrorist or a terrorist supporter. And, you know, I think it's very courageous, very gutsy to make the distinctions that you were making and to be willing to go and talk to the people there. Now, what did you see and what did you hear?
Well, I saw, as I was saying before, a lot of overwhelmingly positive reactions from people. One highlight was the press conference that we attended with Imran Khan. We got some mainstream media coverage out of that. Also, when I first arrived at the airport after a 13-hour flight, we were greeted by hundreds of people who were with the Afia Siddiqui support group. For those of you that don't know anything about her, she is a woman who is an American-educated Pakistani neuroscientist, and she's been sentenced to 86 years in prison for assaults attempted. It started out as terrorism charges, I believe, but ended up being attempted assaults on U.S. soldiers. So it's been described as a gross miscarriage of justice by many. But her supporters were very glad that we were there, and we're hoping that we would bring attention to that cause. And we were showered with rose petals and given flowers. Other highlights were one of the last days that we were there, Medea and other people participated in a fast from 6:30 in the morning until sundown to protest the drones. And it was outside the Islamabad Press Club, and we got some press attention there. And that was a great opportunity for me to talk one-on-one with a lot of people that were just walking by and saying, what's this pink? Who are these, you know, mostly middle-aged women? What? They're not eating. What's going on? And that's where I had a lot of great conversations with people who were asking, what is going on over there in the U.S.? If you are here against these drone attacks, then why do we see half of your population supporting these politicians who are very much pro-drone?
Were you able to document in video and photograph?
Yes, I did, and I haven't put that up yet, but there are other people who have documented and recorded a lot of the events, and it's on the Code Pink website. And there's also a lot of information at droneswatch.org.
We've seen a pattern. They just returned to the Siddiqui case of people who really didn't engage necessarily in terrorism, but have been labeled terrorists. I think there was a protest today at Foley Square about the Holy Land Foundation supporting Palestinian rights, and the people in it being accused, often set up as terrorists, and not given much of an opportunity by our media to explain these issues. There's been a pattern of, you know, various provocative cases that have been actually, in many cases, it seems like created by the government itself, by police agencies. And this Siddiqui case seems to be one. So this is something that I think people who are listening in ought to think about and try to find out more about, because in the name of the war on terror, we've had a war of error, a war of abuse of civil liberties and the like. And the Center of Constitutional Rights here in New York has been very active to try to defend these cases. But a lot of these people are getting like 80-year sentences, essentially, you know, capital sentences for raising money for victims of, let's say, the bombing in Gaza and the like. And this is something that I think that we need to really look at. It's a shameful situation, and the power of the prosecutors, the power of the media seem to be fused because of so much fear among Americans about terrorism and the like.
And, well, that, and that fear plays into this narrative of this is a dangerous place, this is a dangerous country, those people are crazy, and drones is an effective way to deal with it. And if we don't do that, then it's going to result in an unstable situation, which is ultimately going to affect our own security. But what the evidence is supporting is actually the opposite of that. We met a woman who just did her master's thesis, received her MPhil from Cambridge University, and showed with empirical evidence that drone attacks are part of what motivates suicide bombers. So this certainly is going to destabilize the region, and this, that's going to result in the greater chance, not only that, but,
you know,
lack of security for us all.
You know, we're worrying, all of us, you know, in official circles, which doesn't include myself, about nuclear, you know, weapons being made in Iran, you know, at the same time, Pakistan has nuclear weapons and India has nuclear weapons provided in part by the United States or technology, American technology. So, not to mention Israeli nuclear weapons, which the Israeli government basically neither denies or confirms, but everybody realizes that they're there, maybe as many as 600.
Yeah.
Do we know who the manufacturer of the drones is? I mean, just out of curiosity.
We do know who some manufacturers are. I don't know off the top of my head. I know that the Upstate Coalition Against Drones is at, I think they're there right now at the base at Hancock protesting the entrance to the base, because they do have some of the pilots there who are in charge of executing the missile strikes.
This is what's,
and where they are manufactured and where they're coming from.
Is it Lockheed Martin? Is that?
Well, we have a military industrial complex. If drones are selling, then they're making them. You know,
And we have all kinds of countries, Israel, Sweden, Germany, that are involved in the manufacture, distribution, and
there's also, you know, there's also an increase in the number of applications to the Federal Aviation Administration,
yes,
for drone use in the United States. And some of this has been granted, and there's likely to be more of this.
I think the estimate is 35,000 drones in U.S. airspace by 2014. That could potentially happen.
That's exciting, isn't it?
I just wanted to address, you know, the fear, like you brought up, you know, the fear in Americans, like being afraid to, you know, to say anything or to go over there as you did. But, I mean, in reality, it's more scary if you don't do anything. I mean, you're actually encouraging, right, drones to be here by being afraid of, you know, standing up and, you know, at least doing something. I mean, your experience, you said, was a really positive one, which is amazing.
Yes, you know? There was never a time where I felt threatened or unsafe. I actually got very sick at one point and didn't go to the march on Waziristan. And in the tribal areas is where you do see a lot more people walking around with AKs. So, but that's not dramatically different from states where you have open carry. But that was a little bit unnerving for some people.
Were you required to have to wear some special something?
We worked with a really great organization in all the planning logistics called the Foundation for Fundamental Rights. And the head attorney, his name is Shahzad Akbar, was giving us a little cultural schooling before we went there. And he said that it's not in Islamabad, it's not necessary to cover your hair, but you'll win brownie points if you do. Oh. So I covered my hair the whole time.
Yeah.
In the tribal areas in Waziristan, which again, they didn't actually enter because they were blocked by the Pakistani government.
I would be, you know, why not? I mean, you know, let
me just get to this point about what's partly bizarre about this. Here we have a bunch of people sitting in Las Vegas, Nevada, at an air base outside of Vegas, and they go to work for 8 hours, and they sit in front of a console and basically play war games with people's lives. They target. It's all kind of video feeds and whatnot, and direct, you know, death on people's heads. You know, 20,000 miles away, and don't really see the consequences, the collateral, so-called collateral damage, the human consequences of all of this. So that's bizarre right there about how this whole drone plays out. That's
right. And some are able to disassociate from what they do and just look at it as a job, but others are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. So there, I think cognitive dissonance does come into play, and
supposedly Obama has a kill list, from what I heard. Anybody hear?
I hope you're not on it, Catherine. If you keep interrupting me. No,
I'm going to be on Danny's kill list.
One of the highlights of the trip also was meeting with the U.S. ambassador, and we talked about that process. And it's very opaque. It's not transparent. And that's...
How did the U.S. ambassador receive this delegation? I'm sure American ambassadors don't get exposed to anti-war organizations.
Right. Well, it was Ambassador Hoagland. And we were very impressed and pleased that he did come to our hotel where we had a conference room and speak with us. And that's where he did allude to this statistic of there being the number of civilian casualties being in the two digits. So we asked, a two digit, is that 10 or is that 99? And it was just this usual line of, I can't comment in a...
Well,
reasons of national security.
Let me just urge you to pick up Medea Benjamin's book on drone warfare. You might want to look at a column I wrote today on Media Channel, or rather on newsdissector.net, which is my metaphor of drone warfare in America attacking us in the form of political commercials, raining down on us from the sky. People don't know who actually contributed to a lot of these advertisements. It's secret, and it's really made to define the outcome of the election that we're participating in. And so I see this in a sense, a similar election by remote control, war by remote control. What is the website for your efforts?
People can go to the Code Pink website. They can also go to droneswatch.org. You could also follow me on Twitter at Smillarock, which is SMILLARAAQ.
That's going to be easily remembered by anybody who hears it.
It's the main character in a book called Smilla's Sense of Snow by Peter Hoog.
Okay, well, it's a great reference. You can also, of course, follow me on newsdissector.net every day. You're also quite invited to comment by writing to dissector@mediachannel.org, listening here to Progressive Radio Network. This program will be in our archives, and you'll be able to get the podcast and listen to it on iTunes and the rest. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you very much for being on the air with us. I think we're running out of time. According to the maestro at the controls, who isn't looking at me right now and is not signaling how much time I have, but he's saying 1 minute, so I really have to wrap up.
Okay, could I just say quickly, I'm going to be giving a talk on this topic at the Greater Astoria Historical Society at Occupy Astoria Long Island City's General Assembly this Sunday, and in November I'll also be speaking at Queens College with Professor Ziva Backman-Flamhaft in the Political Science Department.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, Catherine, for being with me. I'm not going to be here next week because I'm going to be in Los Angeles. But we're trying to arrange the program to go on. And then after that, I'll be in South Africa during the month of November. But I'm hoping to maybe arrange to Skype the program and with Catherine and keep us on the air. News Dissector Radio, Progressive Radio Network, and PRN.FM. Thank you for joining us.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was